When I agreed yesterday to move my talk today, I did not anticipate that the last time I really worked on the problem was 3 years ago, and that I couldn't actually make sense of my notes anymore. And so basically, I understood what I'm going to tell you at 2 a.m. last night. So it's a bit improvised. Also, the talk I'm going to give now does not necessarily have any connection to the abstract, because when I wrote the abstract, I did not actually understand what I'm going to say now. So yeah, my talk today is going to be very much in the spirit of yesterday's talk. So it's I'm just going to tell you about some structure I looked at a long time ago. And it's for those who want to sit down and get into the dirty work of working out the nitty-gritty details and trying to solve more equations and find some new seeks. So it's a bit technical, but I hope that some of you can end up making use of the structure. Okay, so the structure I'm going to talk about is based on a very simple realization, which I guess every one of you has been exposed to, namely that if I look at the integers mod d, the ring of integers mod d, then and d is a composite number, so I can factor it into its prime components like that, with some prime numbers p and some exponents e. Then it is true that that d is isomorphic to the direct sum of that di, where di is just pi to the ei. Right? And while that is widely known, it implies a bunch of more decomposition effects, namely the Heisenberg. So if you then go to a Heisenberg Weyl representation defined over that d squared, then also the Hilbert space the operators act on factorizes with respect to this decomposition, and the Weyl-Heisenberg operators factor, and also the Clifford group factors and the metaplectic representation factors and the symplectic group and that factors, and everything decomposes, and that can potentially be used to simplify the constraints on fiducial vectors in small composite dimensions. And I'm going to give you some examples in dimension 6, and I was hoping yesterday evening that I could push it so far that I could tell you how to find an analytic fiducial vector in dimension 6 using these techniques. That didn't quite work, but anyway, I cut down from what are a priori, I guess, 10 real parameters in dimension 6 to 3 real parameters, and I have a bunch of constraints I haven't even used yet. So with a bit of more time, I think this might be used to find such a solution in d equals 6 with very little algebra and a lot of group theory, which might potentially be nicer or not. Okay, so just to fix notation, the Weyl-Heisenberg group is a representation of ZD cross ZD, and that is represented with unitary operators in U of D. And unfortunately, my definition, the one I'm using, are slightly different from Marcus's, which I guess most of the other people are not using who work on seeks, because he wrote that very usable paper. Yeah, but I figured it would confuse me too much to change them, so I'm just going to give you the definition. And so I would say that W is a Weyl operator. It takes two parameters, P and Q, each being numbers in ZD. And it is defined as omega D, and omega D is the usual D squared of unity to the minus 2 to the minus 1 P times Q Z of P times X of Q, where 2 to the minus 1 is the modular inverse of 2 mod D if D is odd, or it's just 1/2 if D is even. These Z and X are the usual Pauli operators, as you would use them too. Okay, so I want, all right, okay. So we already know that ZD can be decomposed this way. I'm now going to show you that this implies a tensor decomposition of CD isomorphic to C, tensor product over I, CDI. And it implies that the group we usually look at as L2 of ZD is actually a direct sum over E as L2 of ZDE, DI. And also, the Weyl operators factor, so W of P and Q. It's nothing but a tensor product over I, W of PI and QI, and that the unitary representation of this group, which I denote with this mu for metaplectic, is actually a tensor product over I of mu of SI. And that all these relations can be used to simplify constraints, slightly simplify constraints on fiducial vectors. So this decomposition of ZD is basically the Chinese remainder theorem. And it's basically very simple up to some small caveats. And I'm going to, so for example, this factorization is almost trivial, but not quite. There's one little thing one has to keep in mind. So in order to show you what the little thing is you have to be aware of, I'm now going to put you through 50 minutes of Chinese remainder theorem basics. If that's too boring for you, please tell me and then I speed up, even though that would risk losing me on the way, because I'm not so familiar with that, so I have to remind myself every time I go. Okay, so let's talk about Chinese remainder. We want to make the isomorphism ZD isomorphic to ZD1 explicit and learn something on the way. And going into this direction is very simple, because if I just take a number A, which is in this residue class, I can map it to a vector A mod D1, which I call A1. And there's a reason I'm using superscripts here and not subscripts, and that will become apparent in a couple of minutes, to A mod DK is AK. And it is clear that this direction is a homomorphism, because mod DK is a homomorphism. And so this direction is pretty simple. It is not so obvious how to invert this relation. And this is what I'm going to show you now, how to do that, how to, if I have a vector here in, in this direct sum, how to associate it with a number in ZD. Yes? Yes, that's right. D I is P I to V I. A ring homomorphism of multiplication and addition in that ring. Each one is, yes, that's right. And hence the entire one, right? Because, well, A B mod D plus A mod D times B mod D, which is true mod D, and same for addition and all that, right? Okay, so let's call this direction alpha, and let's find out what alpha to the minus one is. And to this end, I want to introduce a basis in this space, and it's going to be the obvious basis. I will call fi, by fi I will mean the vector, which is zero everywhere except on the ith position. Okay? And that is position number I. So I want to find out, and that's obviously in the space, right? So I want to find out what is alpha to the minus one fi. So which number gives me exactly 1, 1 if I apply this method to that vector? Okay, so what do I have to prove here? Okay, I will write down the solution, and then I will prove to you why the solution is correct. So I say, I make a claim here. Alpha to the minus one of fi, that is the following object, which I will define in a second, ni times ni to the minus one. Right, so what do I mean by that? Well, ni is defined as d divided by di. So it's a product of all dimensions, leaving out the d factor. And here, I take the inverse of ni, but I take the modular inverse mod di. So that is the modular inverse of ni mod di. Okay? So the number which, when multiplied with ni, gives 1 mod pi. Right? Is that clear? You can say no, but say something. Yes, OK. Right. So I want to prove that. And I have to prove that ni times ni to the minus 1 mod di mod dj is, that's what I need to prove. Well, it must be 0 if I is not equal to j, and 1 if I is, in fact, equal to j. And but that's very simple to see. Because let's first look at the upper line here. Remember that ni contains every di, every dj except for di. So in particular, it contains dj. So this number is 0 mod dj if j is different from I. So we have proven this line here. So now let's prove this line. Yeah, but that's true by definition, right? Because the right-hand factor has been defined to be the inverse of the left-hand factor mod di, right? So we have proved this one too. Okay. I can give you an example. And if you don't want to have that example, I'm still going to give it, because I need that example, because otherwise I'm going to be confused. So the example I'm going to talk about anyway is d equal to 6, right? So in d equal to 6, we have, I want to say 6 is 3 times 2. So 3 is the first factor, 2 is the second factor. So n1 would be 2, n2 would be 3, right? And so n1 to the minus 1 mod d1, right? That is the object we need here. That is the inverse of 2 mod 3, which is 2, right? Because 2 times 2 is 4 is 1 mod 3, right? And n2 to the minus 1 mod d2, that's the inverse of 3 mod 2, but 3 is already 1 mod 2. So the inverse of 1 is 1, so that's 1, right? Okay, now we can say the vector 1, 0, that is f1. This maps to what we've just proven here, ni times the inverse. So that is 2 times 2 is 4. And f2, 0, 1, maps to 3 times 1 is 3. OK. So now we can go back and forth between this representation, the factorized representation, and the representation of numbers mod 6. OK? Good. So I'm going to slightly abuse notation. And now that I have this isomorphism between those two sides, I will be a bit sloppy about distinguishing them. So sometimes I'm going to call this number f1, and I'm going to call that number f2, too, even though I shouldn't be doing that. But now I got used to it, so being more consistent would not confuse me. And a confused speaker will lead to a confused audience in the end. And so at least we have the chance that one person in the end will not be confused. OK, so now I ought to tell you how I define my tensor product structure on CD. And I will show to you how and in what sense the while operators are going to factorize with respect to that structure. And in the end, of course, how we're going to use it to our advantage to find fiducial vectors. OK, so CD is isomorphic C6, or CD is isomorphic to C tensor product over E over IDI. How do I define that? Well, I just take an element of the computation basis in here, right? And remember that x is just an element of that d. And so I can write x as a sum over xi fi, right? Where xi here is an element of ZDI. And these are the basis numbers we've derived before. And I'm just going to map that. I'm going to introduce my tensor product structure by saying, well, that by definition is a tensor product over I, xi. Okay, makes sense because that is also in ZDI, which are the tensor factors we have here. Okay, and now I make a claim. And the claim is that the poorly x operator factorizes, namely that we have the following relation. Okay. I'm going to prove it to you. It's going to be very simple. And don't be too cocky, because then we do it for the z operator, and there is little subtlety. And yeah, it's a bit more involved than you might think on first sight. So OK, so how do I prove that? Well, it's very simple, because I say, OK, I take this operation here well, and that is by definition x plus q, right? And now I use the fact that this operation I have is a homomorphism, so addition is component wise. So that is nothing but sum over I, xi plus qi fi, right? But that is nothing but the tensor product over I, xi operator, qi acting on xi. So that was very simple. So now we're doing the slightly more involved calculation for the z operation, and I hope I'm not going to screw that up. Z of p of x. Now what is that? That. What was that comment?
No. Okay.
Okay. So that is omega d by definition. P times x, right? That is the same definition everybody is using. X. Okay. Now that is nothing but x of 2 pi I 1 over d sum over I. Now multiplication is also component wise, so it's p I x I and f I. X. And now let's plug in the definition of this number fi. This was ni times ni to the minus 1 with respect to di. I'm sorry, the way it is. I wish it were simpler. Okay. So now we have, we're going to unite these two terms, right? So we have x 2 pi I, okay, there are two different i's here, right? It's a complex I and the index I, but you're not going to confuse that, I guess. Ni over d, sum over I, pi, ni to the minus 1 mod di xi, fi. I'm sorry, I'm putting you through that. Okay, but this we know, ni was the product of all dimensions except for the ith factor, so this is nothing but 1 over di, right? Which is good, because now here, this must be in the sum of parts, because this is dependent on, right? Because, okay, now we have an exponential of a sum, so let's write it as a product. So that's a product over I, almost there, x, 2 pi I over di, p I n I to the minus 1 d I. Sorry, this we don't need anymore because we put in this number already. X. Okay, that's good, because we want to factorize it. So we gave this definition in terms of the global z operator. Now we want to phrase it in terms of the local z operators. And this is the right phase we have here, right? So that's omega d I. The di-th root of unity, but the xi I forgot. However, there's a small change here. We have this extra factor we have to care about. So if I write it as a tensor product, it will look like that. Tensor product over I, that of pi times ni to the minus 1 mod bi xi xi. So we do not get exactly the same form as we would expect, because we have this extra factor here. And so how do I take care of that? Well, I make a definition, which I guess is somehow inspired by the notation you find in relativity. I define that to be pi with a lower index I. And yeah, this is a notation which works great once you understood it, but has the potential of eternal confusion if you don't. But it actually makes sense, because x and p are in many situations indeed conjugate variables, so they auto transform in conjugate ways. Also, if you set up a theory of wide operators over finite field, you have to use dual bases in order to express your elements, and then again you have this kind of duality. So it actually makes sense to put it that way. So then we have that z of p factorizes as tensor product over I zi to the pi with a covariant index, right? And so you can use these calculations then easily to write down the rule for factorizing wide operators, which would then obviously be. So there's two ways of accounting for, well, I mean, I guess there's many. So in some way, you have to account for this factor here. There's no way to get around that. So I absorbed it into the coordinates. You can also absorb it into the z operation and define a different character for every tensor factor. But then the local z operations would depend on the global dimension, which I find somehow odd. So I prefer to modify my coordinates. Also, it makes sense if you, oh, sorry, this would be a index here. Also, it makes sense if you compare it to like the finite field case where you have exactly the same situation. So yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe this is an artifact I'm introducing here, but I think this is a good way of handling it. So that's an important formula for us. So it deserves a purple cartouche. that how you call it? A cartouche? Okay. Yeah, so it basically looks trivial because we've hidden the non-triviality into this little notational trick. Okay, so we have mastered that, and then I'm just going to tell you the result for the next thing we have to decompose, namely these are symplectic transformations. So if S is an element of SL 2 of ZD, then I've claimed that S is actually a direct sum over SIs, which act on these in these smaller rings. Yes? Sorry, you mean this two?
So, yeah, I mean, you chose.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, where do I have it? Yeah, 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 I'm just, I know what you're talking about, but I don't know where I put it here. There we go, this one. Yeah, yeah, I'm doing it for exactly the same reason as Marcus does it, namely for the reason that. It may or may, I don't actually know. I think there's a slight difficulty because you have P and Q turned around, and also the order here, you have the opposite order, I think. I don't really know. So So I started that way, and also this Neuhauser paper, which I think you know uses that way. I think that's where I copied it from. Sorry? Yeah, so I don't know. It's basically, we have the same reason. It's basically the same. These two conventions are going to be related by some unitary, but I don't actually know what it is. And every time I transfer stuff from his notation into mine, I have to struggle for half an hour to get it correctly. And mainly it's, I guess, and change all the minuses until everything works. Yeah. So this the reason why I've chosen, or other people have chosen the convention, is that so the Clifford group is the metaflectic representation, as I've pointed out several times now, and this it maps while operators onto transformed while operators, and you do not want to pick up a face under the action of the Clifford group. And if you don't want to pick up an extra face, you have to go for either Marcus or mine or Neuhauser or whoever definition, right? Okay, so that's the reason. So I ought to tell you, and I'm just going to state the result because I wouldn't be able to derive it here anyway because it would confuse me way too much, is if I have such an S, and an S is just a block of four numbers, all from ZD, so it would be S, PP, S, PQ, I guess, S, QP, and S, QQ, I have to tell you how to get the SIs. And there's going to be some modifications along this line. And I just copy what I derived 2 years ago and then yesterday night again from, I hope it's correct. Well, I think it's correct, actually. No. So the answer is that. And so the components which do not mix position and momenta, they are kind of simple, right? Because I stay within the same coordinate system. But here, those off-diagonal elements, they take covariant numbers and output contravariant numbers or the other way around. So you get these extra transformation numbers here. OK, so yeah, so if you know that, then you have enough structure to factorize, for example, Zorner's matrix, right? So what you want to have in the end, I'm just going to tell you the result. So for D equal to 6, we have that, well, the matrix we are all after is this one, I guess. And this turns out to map to, and I know it because I did it yesterday, to map to this matrix acting on the third and on the three dimension and the two dimensional space. So you see, you have to factor in all these modifications because it's not just the matrices don't reproduce, right? You pick up some extra faces, and if you don't put them in, nothing is going to work. Yeah, that's right. Yes, you do. You can read that off this formula, right? So if it's zero, it will remain zero. I don't know if it's going to be more ugly looking in other dimensions. I haven't actually done it. I think I have it for 15 yesterday night somewhere in my increasingly desperate notes. There's the 15 solution. You don't get ones necessarily. Yeah. So this was 1 a.m., so I was happy after it worked. Okay. So now we know all the theory, so we leave phase space here and go into Hilbert space, and we'll write down a fiducial vector, and we see how far we can get using these realizations in order to simplify the notorious constraints. So we have a vector psi now in C6, and we assume that it's an element, that psi is a fiducial, and we assume that mu of Z, right, so the metaplectic representation of Zorner's matrix of psi maps it to some multiple of itself. And okay, so we know also that psi is actually an element of C3 tensor C2 in a way we can now make explicit. And so with respect to that decomposition, we can write psi equals C1 A1 B1. I'm just writing down the Schmidt decomposition, where I have imposed that those coefficients are real and all the vectors involved normalize and mutually orthogonal, right? And okay, so let's see how much information we can get out of this decomposition. And let's just list whatever comes to our mind. So the first thing I want to tell you is that I want to convince you of is that C1 is not the same as C2. So these two Schmidt coefficients are different. So the state is not strictly maximally entangled, and that turns out to be important for the next step. And why is that the case? Well, it's very simple, because assume psi were maximally entangled, in fact, right? Then I can use a sig POVM, and it's actually, I can use a sig POVM to do tomography, obviously. So I can look at all the translates of psi acting on an operator of that form, where x is a traceless matrix. So if psi were maximally entangled, then what I would get here is actually trace the identity with some normalization times x, which is 0. Right? And if one of these psi's is maximally entangled, then every element of that CQVM set is maximally entangled because they are all related under local unitaries, because the unitaries, the while operators, are a factor with respect to the decomposition. So I would get 0 all the time, so I could not reconstruct that phrase as operator, so they can't be maximally entangled. Okay, good. So we've established that. But that's good, because now if I act on psi with that operation, then what I'm really doing is I'm acting on all these components individually. So that is C1 mu of Z3 times A1 tensor mu of Z2 times B1 plus and the obvious term here. And now, because these are unitaries, they map Schmidt vectors onto Schmidt vectors. And so if the entire, if that sum is going to be an eigenvector of that operation, then all the two summons here must in fact be eigenvectors already, which means that A1 and B1 must in fact already be eigenvectors of the respective metaplectic matrices. And this is only true because they are not maximally entangled. Right? Otherwise, we couldn't reason this way. Okay, so we have learned something. We have learned that the AIs and the BIs are eigenvectors of the relevant Clifford operations. Okay, so now let's go on. Let's look at this factor here, because that's simpler. That's living in a two-dimensional space. That's very small. So I claim that that 2 is an order 3 matrix. But that is clear, because the order of Z6 is just the least common multiple of the orders of the direct summons. And it's in fact 3, which is a prime number. So the order of Z2 must be either 1 or 3. Can't be 1 because it's not the identity, so it must be 3. So it's an order 3 unitary in a two-dimensional space. So it has only 2 unique eigenvectors, and they are fiducials. Right? Oh, well. So we can conclude that B1, B2 are fiducial vectors. So decomposing a seq, we find 2 smaller seqs, if you want. And that's good, because from here we can make our third realization. Let's look at psi, the identity on the three-dimensional subspace, tensor a while operator, p, q, acting on the qubit space, psi. Right? If you plug in the decomposition, you get c1 squared b1 w of p, q, b1 plus the second obvious term. Right? And now we use the fact that in the qubit case, they are Hermitian, right? Right. So that's a real number. So we know that this here is plus minus 1 over square root of 3, right? And the same we get here. And from that, we get an equation for C1 squared and C2 squared. There's a second equation, namely they must add up to 1 because it's a normalized vector. And from that, we can compute that C1 and C2 are actually of the form 1 half 1 plus minus 3 over square root of I don't know what, something. Right? So we can compute the Schmidt spectrum of a fiducial vector. Now that's not nice. So we can now go back to our cartouche and mark all the elements. Oh no, did I actually cartouche it? Oh, I should have. So there's going to be something of a cartouche inflation here. We can now mark all the elements in that decomposition, which we can compute explicitly. Right? So we know C1, we know C2. We know B1 and we know B2. Okay, so that's not so bad. So we have to think a bit harder to get some more information here. But we can, fortunately, very easily, because we haven't yet So this is bullet point 4. We haven't yet used the fact that indeed the A's, the putrid vectors, are also eigenvectors of a metaflectic operation. So let's look at the spectrum of the operator they are eigenvectors of. And you can compute that using your favorite phase convention, and then you get the spectrum is omega 3, which is a one-dimensional eigenspace, and then it's 1, which is a two-dimensional eigenspace. Right? So, okay, and we know that A1 and A2 live either here or there. It'd be nice if we had one in here, because then it would be uniquely fixed, right? Because it's a one-dimensional space. And we are lucky, because we can show that that's always the case. Because, okay, look at this equation here. Well, no, look at this equation here. Look at this equation, the Cartouche one. So we know that that's an eigenvector of some Clifford operation, and that's an eigenvector. But they are orthogonal, and they live in a two-dimensional space. So this must be an eigenvector to some eigenvector, eigenvalue lambda 1. And that must be an eigenvector to some different eigenvector, value lambda 2. Right? But now if I get another phase when I act with mu of z 3 on the first factor. But the product of these two phases must work out to be the same value, because, well, the global thing is an eigenvector. Right? So because we have two different values here, we need to have two different values there. So A1 and A2 must come from two different eigenspaces, which means that one of the two of them must live in this one-dimensional eigenspace. Okay, so that's good. So one vector is uniquely fixed by that. Say it's A1. I'm not losing generality here if I have not already decided on an order for indices. And so I can say A1 is the unique non-degenerate eigenvector of mu of Z3. And now I can, that matrix, it's a very simple, it's a 3x3 matrix, so that's a simple object. So I can just diagonalize it, and I can look at this eigenvector, and I can just write it down explicitly, and I will find that, A1 is a stabilizer state, indeed. That's a bit unfortunate, right? Because in the qubit space, we got the Schmidt vectors were Sieg fiducials, and it'd be nice to have Sieg fiducials on the other hand too, so other side too, so that we could like build Siegs from Siegs. That's not quite true, unfortunately. So A1 is a stabilizer state, but I mean, still, it's a simple enough state, and it's actually stabilized by, I can write that down, by the translation operation, which translates along a diagonal in phase space by W11. Okay, so let's go back here. So let's keep book of what we know. So now we know A12. Let's count parameters, how many parameters are missing. So the only object which we don't have full knowledge about as of yet is A2. And so these are four vectors described by four real parameters, minus 1 for normalization. Unfortunately, not minus 2, because the phase does matter. So there are 3 real parameters left. There are also a bunch of easy equations I can get for A2, utilizing the fact that A1 is a stabilizer. Because if I now look at the Heisenberg Weyl translations of psi, I know that when there are Heisenberg Weyl group elements which orthogonalize A1. And those which leave it invariant. In fact, one of the two must occur. This gives me a bunch of easy equations for A2, and I hoped I could work that out during the lunch break to present you a full solution, but I couldn't. But I'm still optimistic that it may be possible to, at least up to the phase, get everything easily analytically done just using these symmetries. But I couldn't manage doing that. And that is what I wanted to tell you about, mostly. That's it.
really simplistic question.
Please.
So, I mean, suppose I just took just all the products of Heisenberg.
Yes.
Operators, or whatever you want to call them, for the different factors of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably you don't do that because you want to get these phases to work out right. Is that the reason, or is there something?
I mean, that's what I'm doing, right? So the set of all Heisenberg one operators for the big space, if I may abuse the word coined by Marcus the other day, is just the tensor product of all the Heisenberg one operators on the smaller spaces. And it's actually a bit surprising because remember that if we have a prime power dimension, for example, 4, 2 to the 2, then there are two ways of defining Heisenberg one operator there, namely the cyclic ones and the factoring ones. And it turns out that the factoring ones do not work, right? They improve that you cannot use factoring ones to generate fiducial vectors, but the cyclic ones do. And this is all the more surprising when you realize that in 6, which is 3 times 2, the Heisenberg one group factors automatically, right? So, it is. So the factorized structure you have always, except for the case when you have non-trivial exponents in your prime decomposition of the dimension. And in these cases, you should not factor further, but take the cyclic versions. So but in the light of this point of view, I think it's all the more surprising that it doesn't work for.
But I mean, why instead of factoring and just sort of start with some things and just take all the products, see what you get?
Well, I mean, take products of the Heisenberg one operators.
Take products of the cyclic ones for the prime powers.
Yeah, but that's what I'm doing. It's what everybody's doing implicitly.
Okay. But it just seems like, I mean, you can just write that down.
You can write all the Heisenberg one operators down, surely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you sort of start from the big one and factor it.
No, I mean, what I'm showing is that everybody's doing exactly that automatically. Of course, you can start and say, I never cared about that. 6, I just care about that 3 tensor, that 2. And what I'm telling you is there's a difference between that and what everybody does. And it relates to the question I had yesterday about those nice error groups we had with a billion factor groups, right? I mean, this is basically, you have some abelian group by the characterization theorem of them. You can just write them as that direct product of that B, and they all factorize into as small components as possible.
So it'd be more surprising if these things gave different solutions, right? Because of the fact that these abelian groups are isomorphic.
Right. So what I'm saying is again, many of those all of these nice error groups with abelian base groups, I would believe, maybe that's a fact I'm overlooking, but I would believe you're just getting the good old Heisenberg wild man in disguise. Right. So there is not actually anything new when you do it. At least I believe that's so.
What's the group theoretical fact that makes it not work for further factorizing prime powers? I know it's probably only.
Group theoretical, yeah, I think there's no reason why it should work. It's just an amazing fact that it doesn't. Okay. You have some, in these dimensions, you have some ambiguity about which group to take. And a priori, there's none of the threat of the other one, but for some reason, the cyclic ones seem to work and the non-cyclic ones do not seem to work. But many of us conducted numerics before 82, they were futile. So I don't think there's any theoretical justification.
Of course, Huggett's lines are quite.
Huggett's, that's right. So for 2 to 3 is the only exception.
Numerically, you can guess what they are quite simple compared to the other fiducial vectors. So maybe this approach is a good idea. Might not get it in every dimension, but which is quite simple.
Right. So yeah, people could look at 3 squared and at 5 squared, and for those two, I seem to remember that 3 years ago, numerical didn't find anything, but my numerical skills were not good enough to extend it to any higher dimension. Yeah, but okay. I mean, anyway. So the basic message, in any case, would be to that the factoring structure, which is there, even though some people may have overlooked it until now, can be used to find a representation of your vector, where for each component of that representation, you get simpler constraints than the constraints you had on the original object, And so, I mean, the hope we all have, of course, is that if you take these equations, then somehow you can fulfill them bit by bit. And in some sense, I could do that pretty far for, well, I mean, for dimension six. I think you might get similar arguments to work in dimension 10, because 5 is also pretty small, potentially 14, I don't know. And after that, I guess it's going to be really interesting. Yeah, 14 would be interesting. Right? After that, I guess it's going to be very difficult again.
So this method is applicable to the case where you have two different prime divisors? Or is
that
correct?
Right. Yes, that's right. Whenever you have two different prime divisors, or more, of course.
But if you have more, this argument in the first step, it's not obvious to me how you do that.
Which one? Which argument?
The one where you rule out that it cannot be the maximally entangled state.
Oh, okay.
I think you can always rule that out on two designs.
Yeah, I would be interested. Because if one of them is maximally entangled, then all of them are, because we're acting on them by factoring unitaries.
But it's a two design, so in particular the linear entropy.
The linear entropy.
Yes, yes, and it's pretty sub-maximal. How much? It's equal to, because that's a second order polynomial. So it has to reproduce the average over all states. All states are not maximally entangled, so that's strictly less than
that's a good argument.
So it has to be true.
Even for three or more.
Or, you know, p times two, sir. Probably you can generalize the idea. Sorry, did I see him? Yes, Marcus.
So what is the final number of real parameters you get when you apply this?
So, okay, so until the lunch break, I ordered up to three real parameters. But give me 2 more hours and I can maybe go down to maybe one or so.
Since I really wonder if you get much by this decomposition instead of just using at the eigenspaces of the C6 operator and.
Well, if that. Certainly not. So what you save is not so much. So in small dimensions, when you have few parameters to begin with, this might be significant. And this might be so significant that you can go from machine-made to man-made solution, because yeah, I'm pretty close to a man-made solution, right? Which I guess Marx told me now that he has 1 in 6 anyway.
I think it's very similar to this.
All right.
Okay. I think I was doing, I wasn't using the Chinese remainder idea, but I think there are, I actually note, well, Steve noticed that there seemed to be a dimension 2 sig buried in there somehow. So,
yes, and that's actually true for any even dimension, right? For any even dimension not divisible by 4, you have a dimension 2 sig fiducial in there. Right?
It's only going to work for 2, isn't it? That's happening.
Yes. I'm not sure about 3 times something not divisible by 3. One could look at that. But for 2, for sure, for any odd, for any even dimension not divisible by 4, you can find that. And I also have formulas for the Schmidt coefficients in any of those dimensions, right? So that can easily be done.
I've been looking at dimensions divisible by 3. I'm going to try applying your ideas to, because.
Actually, Marcus, would you be interested in giving one of our discussions on the things that you've done in dimensions divisible by 3?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of overlap.
It would be interesting to compare.
Yes. Good.
Right, so,
But this phase convention, doesn't seem that there is always the same phase convention.
Right.
You motivated yours by saying that you don't want to get an extra phase on the transformation.
So I want to have the following formula to hold you with that. Mu of S, W of PQ, mu of S dagger is equal to W of the methods X acting on those two coefficients, and I do not want any e to the I something here. This is what I not want.
But this does not fix the phase. There is still some ambiguity.
Yeah. So there's some group. I'm not quite sure what the answer to that is. There is some ambiguity, but there's some group theoretical reply to that, because so the representation. So any unitary representation of a finite group is fixed by its character, right? And the character is just the trace of the elements. And the trace is 0 for the Heisenberg Wild group, except on the center. And the center is just given, the values on the center are just given by these numbers. So somehow the space convention really fixes your irreducible representation. Okay, I'd have to think about exactly how much the PFP has.
Okay, well, let's thank Dave again. It was very interesting.